Well, greetings once again to everyone out there at TFMR. It is Thursday. You know what that means. It must be time for another A2A webinar. And this week we've got a new guest, a first time, we'll call it an A2A virgin. You like that, Steve?
It's a long time since I've been any form of virgin. I'll take A2A as a default position.
We got Professor Steve Keen on the line. And many of you are familiar with Steve, but if you're not, he is a professor of economics, history, and politics at Kingston University in London. He is famous for his book that he wrote a few years ago called Debunking Economics, and he will soon be famous again for a book he's got coming out in a couple months entitled Can We Avoid Another Financial Crisis? I'm sure that will be very well received. I look forward to seeing it myself. But anyway, Steve, thank you so much for joining us. Really going to be fun to visit with you.
Welcome to be here. Good to be here.
And you know, for everybody listening, if this is your first A2A, we use this GoToWebinar platform so that you can ask the guest your own questions in real time. There's a tab on your GoToWebinar control panel that you click, opens up a dialog box, you type in your questions, and I relay it on to Steve. But we'll do that here in a few minutes because I got a couple of questions to begin with. So, Steve, let's just start right there with the new book. It comes out in a couple of months. Again, it's called Can We Avoid Another Financial Crisis? Let me just ask you, can we?
Well, the question I'm asking in the book is, can we avoid another financial crisis? Because we had one back in 2008. And the answer pretty much is the countries that managed to avoid the crisis, with only a couple of exceptions, managed to avoid it by borrowing their way out of trouble. And it's by borrowing not government debt, which is what people normally obsess about, but private debt. And those private debt borrowed money financed a credit-based boom in those economies that made up for the collapse of credit-based demand in England and America and Spain and so on. But now it's time to pay the piper, and we're talking about virtually 10 years after the crisis began. All those countries now have a massively increased level of private debt. They're dependent upon that continuing to rise, which you simply can't keep on doing. And when their credit engines fall over, they'll have their own crises. And when you add up the countries, there's between 9 and 17 that I'd identify, the most obvious one being China. Other obvious suspects are Canada and Australia, but it includes unusual countries such as Belgium and South Korea. And when they fall over, the combined total, even though they won't fall over at the same time, of course, the combined proportion of GDP that they're worth is slightly more than the USA. So it'll have an impact on demand in the rest of the world as well.
Yeah, it would almost seem inevitable that it would spread all over. In fact, I read something just yesterday. You may have seen it. It was a link on Zero Hedge. It was a new report from some quant at UBS that was talking about just that. Mm-hmm. This global credit demand was falling and that China was almost irreversibly falling at this point. There was no way it could be saved and that we were headed toward a global recession. Is that a bit of what you're talking about?
Pretty much, but it's not coming out of the usual suspects. We normally have the story that it's going to be the United States that has a recession. But what happened to the States, of course, is the scale of crisis had back in 2007. It delevered, not substantially, but enough to give it a bit of headroom to continue having a credit-based boom right now. And so it's growing once more. But the countries that had to continue the bubble after 2007, 2008, they've taken on so much debt that they can't continue that borrowing. That's why the demand is going to disappear. And then, of course, that means there's less demand around the globe as well. So it's enough to cause a global recession in the same way that the United States crisis did back in 2007, 2008.
Well, now, you mentioned before we began recording off air that you were recently at a parliamentary committee or something in London where you were talking about the and the deleterious
this
effects?
Is coming up. I'm actually speaking in a seminar in the House of Lords on the 8th of March, but I'm writing a submission for the parliamentary inquiry over here into the effectiveness of quantitative easing. And this is one thing I've got to say. I'm very pleased to be in England rather than Australia, where I used to be, let alone the States, on this front, because the English seem to be willing to entertain open-ended inquiries and actually listen to people who've got unorthodox views. So I'm looking forward to seeing how that committee reacts to my arguments.
Well, and you've got QE continuing from the Bank of England, right? They restarted an overt QE after the Brexit vote, right? So this is probably something they're curious about as to whether they can continue to do that indefinitely.
Yeah, and the trouble is that they can, of course, there's absolutely no limit to the central bank's capacity to create reserves and thereby affect the money supply indirectly through what they're doing with QE. So they can just keep on doing it indefinitely. The trouble is, it's something I thought at the time when they started doing it, that it's a bit like, I gave the example of the movie The Alien. Those remember the first Sigourney Weaver version where they try to pull the creature off John Hurt. And they snap it with something, and it bleeds an acid which almost dissolves the ship. And somebody responds, "It's an interesting defense mechanism. You don't dare kill it." And that's a bit like QE. Once they try to kill it, I think the market will absolutely tumble, because the QE is providing almost permanent buy side pressure on the market. And I don't think the banks themselves are conscious that's what they've done with it. It's only a thing. I had a hypothesis about it. I think I've confirmed it with a bit of dynamic modeling that I'll be presenting to the committee. And that's scary, because the explanation for the market's so high now is literally, apparently, just literally QE.
Right, right. Yeah, even on the basic level of what's propelling the markets, you got the Fed purchasing all these worthless securities from their member banks, and then those folks take cash and do something with it. And you're right.
Mm. And they're doing a game of hot potato.
Yeah, exactly. Steve, I wanted to, I guess, address that in that QE end before we get to some of the other questions. You know, there's a lot of talk here in the States about President Trump. I still can't get over saying that. Having grown up in the 80s, all of a sudden, you know, to have President Trump, just those two words don't seem to go together real well, but we have him. And he's talking about tax cuts and $1 trillion worth of infrastructure spending. And I've seen one theory bandied about where is this money going to come from? And then it's helicopter money, not so much printed by the Fed, but printed helicopter money printed by the Bank of Japan and by the ECB. What do you make of that theory, that the U.S. will have tax cuts and, these infrastructure spending that are funded by the blatant new creation of fiat by these other central banks?
Well, wrong. it'll be the central bank. It'll be the central bank in England, in America, that does it first off. I mean, this is one of the great frustrations for somebody like me who studies the monetary dynamics very carefully, to hear the sort of stuff people say about what they think is going to cause things to be paid for. If the government decides to run a deficit or sets up plans that require a deficit or has to issue bonds to cover a deficit it doesn't expect, as soon as it issues those bonds, it's got the right to spend the money. Now, you and I tried to do the same thing. We wouldn't be able to spend the money until the bonds were actually sold.
Mm-hmm.
The underwriting system that central banks have with their treasuries is that as soon as the bonds are issued, the treasury has effectively played 100% underwriting role. Where the bonds are sold into the market, they might be bought by Chinese banks or Japanese banks or bought by pension funds in America, whatever else. But the money is already counted as being a treasury account and you can spend it. So there's no requirement whatsoever for that to be funded anywhere except because it's effectively backed up by the Federal Reserve. Now, that's the spending will occur.
Mm-hmm.
It's not like if you're talking about a local council or California, anywhere that doesn't produce its own money and doesn't have a central bank, then the limitations we normally put in our thinking about it are correct. But when you apply it to a sovereign country that produces its own currency, particularly the one that's a global reserve currency, it can just spend as soon as it wants to. What I'm wondering about is how much are they going to attempt to balance the books of the government as they do this, which I think would be a disastrously bad move. I still can't picture which way the Trump administration is going to go on that front.
Well, I've been asked that before, too. I mean, this idea that you can balance the budget or pay down the national debt would be extraordinarily deflationary. I can't imagine anybody seriously attempting that.
I can imagine them seriously attempting it and seriously failing, and this is what worries me.
Yeah.
If you have people following the sort of heritage organization approach argument that you should have a balanced budget by 2017, which is one of the arguments you'll see in the Heritage Foundation's website, the destruction that would do to demand in the economy is virtually unthinkable.
Right.
And, of course, in trying to do it, they'd fail. But the impact of doing that would be massively deflationary.
Right.
And I simply can't pick I thought initially when Trump came in, I was extrapolating what I saw in his personal business behavior. He didn't worry about taking on debt. He didn't worry about paying it back either. And balancing the books was an after the event idea for him. It's the same thing applied at the national scale. You would have huge amounts of infrastructure spending combined with tax cuts, generating a large deficit, which would be massively stimulatory for the economy. And when you look at the numbers of the people who were employed in 2007, who don't have a job today, don't read the unemployment data, that's totally misleading. Read the employment data instead, which is exactly the same websites, the Federal Reserve Fed database. You'll see there's at least 2 million Americans between the ages of 25 to 54 who don't have jobs, who had them back in 2007. And if you go back to 2000, you get up to about 7 million across the whole working age population. That's a huge amount of people who could be absorbed by this increase in demand if Trump did it. Now, the idea of trying to get the economy stimulated by cutting government spending, that's the other possible argument. And really, I won't know what the Trump administration is going to do on economics until they start actually putting their proposals out.
Yeah. And that's obviously going to be a while. And then when they get that actually, all their proposals to actually work their way through the U.S. Congress and be implemented, it's going to take a little while.
Yeah. The one thing I can see them doing is tax cuts. I'll get that through pretty rapidly. Infrastructure spending may be a lot harder, particularly if they try to tie it up with various private sector, public sector deals. So, but there'll be stimulus out of the tax cut.
Yes. All right. Now I've got, a number of questions already piling up for you, Steve. So I'm ready to just dive right in. I've got two of them that were emailed to me and a number of them in queue. So to be respectful of your time, I better turn the floor over to everybody else. These might jump around a little bit because everybody has their own individual questions. So if you're ready, if you don't mind, I'll start laying them on you.
Okay.
This first question was an email question, comes from a gentleman by the name of Cardwell, who says he is an American living in Sydney. He's curious of what you think about the new rule in Australia to slash weekend penalty rates, and might that be the prick that pops the Aussie property bubble?
It could be. I mean, the usual story, people, when they think about cutting wages as a way of stimulating the economy, think that if my wage costs fall, then that's going to stimulate, I'm going to have less costs and the same revenue. If you do it across the board, you're basically cutting a substantial source of demand. So it tends to be one of these things that backfires at the aggregate level. And to me, it's not the crisis wasn't caused by workers having too high wages. The crisis is caused by bankers issuing too much debt. Mm. And the credit servicing costs, meaning a lot of ventures failed, we fell over and there's no more demand coming from credit anymore. If you're going to be taking wages away from workers, you're taking further demand away. It's not a solution. And to me, it's just a continuation of that same old mindset of applying microeconomics to the macroeconomic level, which Australia is unfortunately famous for.
So in the end, is that will that do the job working over that property bubble or not?
No, I think the property bubble itself is going to continue extending it by every time there's any chance that house prices are going to fall, the government dives in to try to drag the private sector back into borrowing money once more. That's why the Australian household sector has the third highest level of household debt in the world. And it's the only one that's in Canada, the only two that are still rising. The other one's falling. It's in Norway. So what they could do with that, I believe they're talking about letting first home buyers use their superannuation money as a deposit. Well, there goes their superannuation savings swallowed into the house price bubble. They're also talking about zero deposit mortgages. And of course, that's a great idea. Why not go for 120% budget rather than 20%? Nobody's ever tried that before. And how about 99-year mortgages? That's a great idea. That must be an original Australian idea. So they'll just keep on trying to push the bloody thing forward. And of course, the trouble is it only continues to work as long as you continue taking on more debt compared to income. They're already at 120% of GDP as the household debt level. Mm. That's creeping towards America's aggregate private debt level, including corporate debt.
My gracious.
Insane. But I have no, knowing Malcolm Turnbull from university days and knowing Tony Abbott from the same. I've got absolute confidence in their capacity to continue leading us up the garden path on the way towards being slaughtered.
Well, I guess that's an excellent lead-in to the other question I had emailed to me. This comes from a gentleman on the site who calls himself Lake Dweller. Now, there's a presupposition in this question that I don't know, maybe you won't agree with that, but his simple question was, which economy, in your opinion, is the most manipulated, Australia's, Great Britain's, or the U.S.?
Probably Australia, because it's been manipulated by trying to continue the avoid the bubble at all times by getting the household sector to lever more. And on that basis, if you compare the level of household debt in particular to GDP and the extent to which the ordinary punters have been sucked into levering the country's prosperity, Australia's at 120% plus, I think it's 123% actually. America's at about, I think about 70, and England's at about 70% or so. So we're far more levered. And it's based on speculation rather than investment in both those countries. So Australia wins hands down.
Fair enough. All right. The first listener question, listening live as we do this, comes from a site user go by the name of Infometron. Just wants to know your opinion, Steve, of the Dodd-Frank, I guess we'll call it law, but it was selectively enforced in the first place. What is your opinion of Dodd-Frank and the implications of its repeal?
Well, the whole idea about Dodd-Frank was to divide up the financial sector into transactions-based versus investment-based banking. And frankly, that's a better, that's a better idea to have a diversified financial ecology rather than having enormous organizations doing everything. So the Dodd-Frank was a move in the right direction because you don't want to have the transactional side of the economy jeopardized by what happens when the credit creation side falls over, which is exactly what we had happen back in 2007. Yep. One of the reasons that it was such a panic to get Bear Stearns going under was that Bear Stearns had managed to corner the market for commercial paper, which was where most wages got paid these days. So when they fell over, that was most likely to mean in, you know, within 2 weeks, Americans weren't going to be getting paychecks. Now, if you have a diversified industrial structure, a financial structure with lots of small banks in different regions who provide funds to the local businesses, where you have some which are transactions based and can't do investment lending, others which are building societies which are literally people have to pull their money to enable houses to be built and so on, that diversified structure is more robust than the generalized one we've gone for. So Dodd-Frank was a move in the right direction, and abolishing it is a move back in the wrong direction again.
Certainly seems that's the way it's headed as well. The next, actually, there's a follow-up from Infometron, and he says, what do you currently think of this, the old efficient market theory and efficient market hypothesis, especially in the light of these now nearly constant central bank interventions in the in Forex and equity market, markets all?
It was always garbage, and this is what I wish people would actually go back and read the original papers. If you read the original papers, you'd never take them seriously. The CAPM paper came out of Sharpe's work on what he called efficient markets, and as part of his hypothesis, he built this nice little model of an individual investor trading off risk which was seen as standard deviation versus return against the cost of having or the return you get from a risk-free asset. And when he got to the point of driving the whole idea of a capital asset market line, he then said to aggregate, of course, everybody's going to have different expectations about the future. So one person will think IBM's going to have a high percentage, high return and low volatility. Somebody else thinks it's going to have a low return and high volatility. But to aggregate, we must assume we all assume exactly the same outcomes. We all agree on the performance of every share on the market, the standard deviations and the means of all their returns ad infinitum. We all agree on that. And all we differ on is our preferences for risk. Now, that is total garbage. Mm-hmm. That would say the conversations you have on a minute-by-minute basis in the office never take place because you all agree about the returns of every share. And it would make it even worse when people like FAMA went through and tested it and found, of course, that it disastrously failed to fit the data. FAMA then finally admitted that not only do we assume people have got exactly the same expectations about the future, we assume those expectations are correct. Now, a theory based on that is not a theory at all.
Yeah.
And that's unfortunately, you know, it works so long as the market is going in the same direction, but it has absolutely no idea of what's driving the trends. It'll cause a reversal at some point, and then down you come crashing.
Yeah, that's an excellent point. All right, next question, actually another two-part question. This one from a guy by the name of Cohen who was listening to us. What will be the effects of peak oil on the global debt bubble?
Well, peak oil has been delayed by using fracking, obviously.
Yeah.
And somebody said the Stone Age didn't end because they ran out of stones. It's because the technology changed. But what is actually happening, which is much more important, is what's called the EROI cliff, the energy return and energy invested cliff.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we're going to get past that, frankly. It's a technological issue, because when you go back and look at oil, look at the amount of energy you had to put in to get oil out of the ground back in the 1880s, it was about a 300-to-1 return. You know, the old, what was that old show, the Beverly Hillbillies?
Yeah.
Par fires a shotgun at a rabbit and hits an oil well.
Yep.
These days, your shotgun's got to be 1.5 kilometers deep over the Gulf of Mexico. And so the cost of energy in versus cost of energy out is far greater than it was back when we first discovered the stuff. But it is still running at something sort of 30 to 50 to 1 in terms of the amount of energy you need to put in to get the energy out in the form of oil. Solar and stuff was running initially at about 3 to 1, 4 to 1, 5 to 1. You've got to get past about 7 to 1 before you start getting enough energy being exploited from its various sources to be able to have most of us not working to actually mine the energy in the first place, but to apply it. And there was serious worry from a lot of people that we were forced to being moved out away from oil by more the pollution and ecological effects than actually shortages. As we made that transition, we'd have a huge drop-off in the energy that we can actually exploit. And I think that's going to prove to be, we're just going to make it across the other side. The improvement in photovoltaics in particular, implies we can get a decent return out of them, like of the order of 10 to 15 to 1. And then we can sort of start building an industrial ecology based on renewable energy rather than oil. But we've came very close. We're not going to run out of the oil, but we're going to be forced to stop using it, particularly forced to stop using the coal. And that's the transition I think we really face in the next 10 to 15 years.
It's interesting to think. That's all part of the fun of economics, is thinking about that kind of stuff. And, you know, on a practical nature, so many of those big energy companies play such a major role in many of the global money markets and commercial paper markets and things like that. It'll be interesting how, as the world has transitioned from their products, how that will impact those markets.
Well, that's a big one, because people talk about the sunk assets. I mean, you've got valuations of those oil, and particularly the coal. I think that's probably the most fragile one. Valuations of that stuff that implies you can dig large amounts of it out. And like with oil, we know that we've probably passed peak normal oil in between 25 and 2015. Fracking has added an additional element onto that, so it's probably pushed that peak out maybe to 2025, that sort of thing. But coal, we could go up to 2300 with the amount of coal we've got on the planet. But if we burn it, we get to the stage we're going to have a carbon dioxide level of 1200 parts per million. And I saw a fascinating Scientific American published article decades ago when I was doing my PhD that said that was the level of acidification of the oceans that led to the formation of oil in the first place, and in terms of dissolved breaches being dissolved by hydrochloric acid coming out of the ocean. So, you know, we simply can't use all that coal. We've got to change across to something else.
Right.
And that means those coal resources are massively overvalued right now.
All right, Cohen's second part of his question, he must be Dutch, because he wants to know, is there any country that is doing fine debt-wise, as he puts it, and what do you think of the Netherlands?
Netherlands, it looks like, I think it's one of the countries I identified as being both potentially currently walking dead of debt and also capable of becoming another debt zombie in the future, because they've got a debt to GDP ratio of something of the order of I think about 240%. So they're in a parlous situation in terms of the level of debt they're carrying, private debt, but they can't they're also, when last time I checked, they were doing a large amount of credit-based borrowing again, so they've got a potential to have themselves in another crisis. As I'm talking, I'm typing one-handed to bring up one of my graphs and see what their ratio looks like, so pardon me jumping around here. Just give me a sec to finish typing the graph and I'll give you the result.
You're multitasking, Steve. That's very impressive.
I'm waiting for the damn graph to come up. Here we go. Let's see. Okay, it's reached a debt ratio of 230% of GDP to one. So 230% of GDP is its private debt level, and it hit its peak back in 2008. So it's one of what I call the walking dead of debt. But it's with such a level of private leverage, it's likely to go into some deleveraging at some stage, and it hasn't actually done that. America and England both delevered by 20 or 30% of GDP from the peak, which is back in, for them back in about 2008, 2010, that region. Netherlands has peaked in 2010 at 247% of GDP.
Close.
And it's gone up, gone up and down a bit, but it's now currently 235% of GDP. So it's paralyzed by excessive debt and unlikely to get much credit-based demand and therefore likely to stagnate.
Hey, but they got lots of free weed and hookers over there, so they got that going for them.
That can keep them going for a while.
Yeah, exactly. All right. I got two questions left for you, Steve. I'd be respectful of your time, and this has been fascinating stuff, and I know we all really, really appreciate it. The next question comes from another site regular who wants to know about how do you handle as an economist data where the inputs change? And that's the way I'm kind of summarizing this. His example is the Dow Jones Industrial Average, which is cited by many as a measure of the stock market. And people compare the Dow versus a Bitcoin or the Dow historically versus gold.
Yeah.
Dow is not static. You know, since 2008, 8 of the 30 companies have been swapped, and you've swapped in things like Apple for Honeywell. So how do you take into consideration as you try to measure things, you know, that these indices and indicators are not always the same thing? They're not static.
I know. That's the that's the survivor bias is massive in the stock market. And people, when they look at indices like the Dow Jones, they'll say that, you know, the Dow Jones took, 25 years to recover after the stock market crash of 1929. When you actually take a good look at it, it didn't take 25 years. It took about 70 years, 60 to 70 years to recover, because if you actually factor in the shares you actually held at the time, most of those companies went bankrupt.
Yeah.
During the so if you actually wanted to survive with the actual package of shares you bought in 1929, you had to wait to about 1999 before you got your money back. So there's a lot of people being conned by accepting those indices as a true indicator of the value of the stock market in general. It's not.
Yeah, and I would imagine it just creates. It's too easy to do just kind of static analysis. I mean, that has to be rather dynamic to try to factor all that stuff in, and that makes it extra difficult, I would think, for most folks.
You have to take it. Like you take when we do your proper comparison, you'll take something like the Russell 5000.
Yeah.
But even there, you've got survivor bias because a substantial proportion of those are going to bankrupt at any particular time, and you will fail to capture that. If you just look at the raw industry, you'll miss by looking at the past wrongly, you'll misguide yourself about the future.
Yeah. All right. One last question in queue, Steve, and it's a follow up from our Dutch friend Cohen. Wants to know what you think the effects would be of a China-U.S. trade war on the debt bubbles in China and U.S. You know, we've got this guy over here, Trump's main trade advisor. His name is Peter Navarro, and he's written books, you know, with titles like Death by China. So, you know, this is coming. What would be the impact of a trade war, if you will, or some increased tariffs, things like that, on the debt bubbles in China and the U.S.?
I'm no great fan of free trade, as people possibly know. I think it's based on a fallacious theory of how wealth is created and what economy should do. But at the same time, if you throw a massive trade war in, you simply totally disrupt supply chains and you disturb economies fairly dramatically. So I'm fairly worried about that, the whole China situation too, particularly in Bannon is talking not just a trade war, but actual war.
Yeah.
And those islands off the coast of China right now have got me quite concerned about what the United States Navy might be directed to do and how the Chinese could react to that. So to me, it's a pretty ugly stuff. I mean, this is one reason I was actually having some people were in the right in America were asking me to advise Trump, and I, having looked at the behavior so far, I'd say, frankly, no, I'm going to sit back and watch what happens here rather than get dragged into that maelstrom. But if they do a trade war with China, they do have reason to say that China did take a large amount of American jobs, but American corporations were behind that, exploiting the terms that China gave them, which of course included, and most people aren't aware of this, China gave them, you know, dirt cheap wages, no regulation costs to worry about at all, so please come out here and save yourselves a large amount of money. But they concluded the term that any American company that opened up operations in places like the Shenzhen Free Trade Zone had to have a Chinese partner, and regardless of the capital the Chinese partner had, within 5 years the Chinese partner had to own 50% of the business. Now that was an incredibly effective way of the Chinese Communist Party and the factory apparatchiks at the time turning themselves into very wealthy capitalists, and using American capital to do it. So there has been a serious loss of employment to China, but I don't know that Trump's policies will return much of that to America.
Yeah, no, I hear you. Well, all right, my friend, and that brings us to an end of the questions that I have in queue. So if you're ready, we have a tradition around here where we call it the final four, just four kind of fun, quick questions on the way out. You can usually answer with whatever pops into your mind, just a word or a sentence. If you're ready, can I hit you with them?
Go for it, mate. Yep.
Well, obviously, you've got this heavy German accent, but I wanted to – I'm kidding. for those of you that can't tell, Steve is Australian by birth. And so, Steve, what is the best rock band to ever come out of Australia? Something like INXS, Hoodoo Gurus, who's the best?
Cold Chisel.
What the heck?
You might not have heard them, but it's Cold Chisel. Look it up. And there's a Jimmy Barnes, and he sings a song called Working Class Man, which is actually the lead for an American movie. Jimmy and the co, I reckon they wrote the most authentic Australian rock and roll, and it was incredibly powerful stuff. So Jimmy Barnes and Cold Chisel.
Cold Chisel. All right. That's
Cold Chisel.
I'm writing that one down. I'm checking them out. All right. But you are now living in London. What is your favorite thing about living in London? That's question two.
Intriguingly, the thing I respect about London is the English are willing to entertain ideas they don't necessarily agree with. And that means that this place is a real fabulous place for debate, discussion, and intellectual engagement. And it's far, two orders of magnitude better than anything I've ever seen in Sydney, and I think probably an order of magnitude better than America, because rather than being shouted down with an opposing opinion, people listen to it, and then they say, well, what about this point, however? And you actually have a civilized discussion.
You mean the way it's supposed to be, Steve?
I hate to say it, mate, but yeah.
Yeah, try having that on a U.S. college campus. See how that goes over. Doesn't work that way anymore. All right, now you travel around the world. So question three is, what is your favorite airline?
Qantas, and that's being a bit of an Aussie on that front, but I have to give you a couple of instances. I mean, the service, and if you want the best first-class lounge in the world, it's in Sydney. And Qantas's first class lounge. It is and the crazy thing is, it's not the best lounge they've got. There's another one you've got to get invited to. I think it's called not the President's Lounge, but something of that nature. And the food is spectacular. The service is brilliant. But on the plane itself, there's one time I was flying back from England. This must be something almost like 20 years ago. I was the only person sitting in this particular wing of a 747, and this back broke down. And I said, look, I can just watch some stuff on my, I think a portable screen device at the time. And this Qantas steward said, no, I've got to fix it for you. So he's climbing all over this bloody projector box, making it work for one customer. And that's something I've found pretty damn good on Qantas so far. So it being an Aussie, but also in terms of respecting the staff and liking the way you get treated and the sort of jovial attitude they've got, that's been my favorite airline.
All right. And lastly, touching, I guess, a bit upon your background economics. What is the bigger joke of a Nobel Prize, the one given to Obama for peace or the one given to Krugman for economics?
Oh, God, that's a tough one. Krugman's work on from the geographic element to economics was not necessarily original. It's one of the accusations against him, but at least it was slightly twisting, bending the envelope. I think probably Obama's peace one will have to go down as the one of the most absurd, because a huge part of what he's done, of course, is authorizing huge numbers of drone strikes.
Yeah.
And I'm sure that's fueling a large part of what we're seeing in terms of the angst between the Muslim world and the so-called Christian world these days. So I've got to go with Obama being a bigger joke.
I wonder if it like sits on a mantle somewhere, and when people come over the house, they just look at it and they just laugh. He like points it out and says, "Hey, look at this, I got the peace prize once."
I know. It's amazing what a good smile will do to let you get away with blue murder.
Exactly. Well, Steve, it's been fabulous. I very, very much appreciate your time and your expertise and sharing it all with us today. The link to your first book, Debunking Economics, is on this podcast page. You can click there. You can go to Amazon and buy it. But also, we'll very much look forward to your new book coming out in a couple months, Can We Avoid Another Financial Crisis? Maybe once that baby's out and rolling, you're out doing some PR for it and stuff like that, we can visit again.
That'd be great. I really enjoy that. Great to chat to you.
Steve, thank you so much. And again, thank you everybody for listening. We'll do this again next week.